This is Empowered Human Academy. Welcome home. We're here to create a life that feels like ours, one that calls us onward and upward because we are living as ourselves, fully and only. I'm Isaac.
And I'm Abe. These conversations are where we explore what it means to be alive and how to stay close to that aliveness with every breath. So, with hearts wide open, let's begin. Hello, empowered humans, and welcome back. We are so grateful that you're here.
Today, we're in conversation with someone who's done the bold and soul-excavating work of leaving an old way of life to rebuild a new one. Christian Piccolini is an award-winning television producer, public speaker, author, peace advocate, and former violent extremist. After leaving the white supremacist skinhead movement he was a part of during the 80s and 90s, Christian began the process of making amends and of creating a new life. He went on to receive a degree in international relations from DePaul University and launched Goldmill Group, a counter-extremism consulting and digital media firm. In 2016, he won an Emmy for producing an anti-hate advertising campaign aimed at helping people disengage from extremism, and today he leads the Free Radicals Project, a global extremism prevention network. Since leaving the white power movement, Christian has helped hundreds of individuals leave hate behind as well.
Throughout this conversation, we discuss self-forgiveness, redemption, combating misinformation, confronting racism, second chances, holding power accountable, and the universal glue that holds us all together. Christian's message of peace through empathy and compassion has taken him all over the world, and we're honored to share his story here.
Christian has written about his involvement with and exit from organized hate in his memoir, White American Youth, and he's the featured subject in season 3 of WBEZ's Motive podcast. He unpacks his disengagement work further in his 2020 book, Breaking Hate, Confronting the New Culture of Extremism, as well as in the MSNBC documentary series of the same name. Christian hosts the F Your Racist History podcast, a scripted history show that tells America's hidden, overlooked, and unknown racist origin stories. After listening to our conversation here, there's lots of eye-opening content to dive into. So, let's get into it.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Empowered Human Academy. Today we are joined with a really powerful human. His name is Christian Piccolini, and you heard a little bit about him in the intro just now. But Christian, how are you doing? What's up?
Hey Abe, hey Isaac. It's really amazing to finally be here.
Yeah, thank you for saying yes to this. We begin, as we always do, with a question of identity, and not necessarily what you present to other people, not necessarily what you introduce yourself at a networking event, not necessarily even what you do, though there might be overlap with all of those things. But when you come home to yourself and you're not looking to be anything for anybody, what words of identity feel like home?
Oh, wow. That is a really deep question. And I think for me, identity, when I am kind of away from everything else and what people might expect of me, I would say I am a creative. I love to create, no matter what that means, whether it's art or music or drafting or just plans. I love to kind of piece things together. And I always kind of saw myself as a creator, even as a little kid.
Yeah. Give me a definition here. You gave me a bunch of examples. Drafting, I'm curious about, like, but what does it mean to create? Like, how do you think about that?
So I love to kind of go from nothing to creating the vision to actually putting pencil to paper with the steps on how to get there. Now, beyond that, that's where I get lost. I get lost in the minutiae. So I'm a strategist, I guess, in the purest sense of the word, is I love to strategize ideas. So maybe even more than a creator, I would say a strategist to that, because I'm not maybe fully seeing some of those things through to fruition.
So is there a way that kind of energizes you in the strategy that like helps you kind of create something that is kind of tangible to yourself? So like, does strategy help you create more consistently versus kind of dreaming and then trying to do something and not seeing it to fruition?
I think strategy brings me peace. I think just kind of like organizing things into a cohesive strategy kind of helps me center myself, because it forces me to maybe sometimes make lists. Sometimes it forces me to kind of think things through before I actually do them. So it kind of centers me, brings me a little bit of peace. And I suppose that goes back my whole life where I've, you know, maybe in earlier years, 25 years ago, had to find a way to strategize myself out of a very dangerous situation to imagine what life might be like on the outside of what I used to be involved in many, many years ago, which was, you know, kind of a very toxic environment. So finding my way out required strategy. Right? It required a vision of what life might look like outside of that situation. And I think I've always kind of carried that through my life.
Yeah, you're known for that, the work that you're alluding to. And I'm pumped to talk about it. I'm really intrigued by the way that we've touched on that subject already, like a way to, if I'm hearing you right, like using strategy as a way to find peace and then applying that to the situation, capital letters, which we'll talk about. Is that a fair assessment? Like, was that your... Is that a fair way to assess your motive at the time? And let's get into specifics in a second. But was it about like finding peace through by way of strategy, I suppose?
I think strategy was kind of a last ditch effort to survive for me in that moment. Okay. I don't know that it was even intentional as much as it was just kind of a raw drive to survive in a different sort of environment, because it was, you know, what I was involved in wasn't who I was. It wasn't part of my DNA prior to that. And finding a way out was almost a necessity, which had to be a very creative strategy. And I think folks will understand more when we talk about it a little bit more. It was difficult. So it had to be a very kind of unique, certainly was unique, because I had never known anybody else to get out of the situation that I had gotten out of. Mm-hmm. So it had to be a very unique strategy. And I think it was something that I probably had inside of me all along, you know, even as a young boy, because I love to kind of envision things. But it served me well, I think, in that moment to save my life.
Yeah, totally. So let's actually just get into it now, if you don't mind. Tell us a little bit about your story, where you were kind of before the situation you're talking about, during, what it was like, and then even connecting how you strategized to get out of it, some specifics.
And what you envisioned. Yeah, you've been using the word vision a few times. I want to know, like, as we're talking about this thing, how that plays into it, the future that you saw and what you did to create that, I suppose.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, that vision was kind of... And always kind of being a part of the unknown, or not knowing what was next. But yeah, my story, part two of my story, which is, I think is in several parts, begins about 23 years ago when I walked away from the American neo-Nazi skinhead movement. I had been a member from the time I was 14 years old in 1987 until I was almost 23 years old in 1996. And I think a lot of people ask, like, okay, well, that should have been a part of your life. Most people are raised kind of in that environment. And for me, I actually was not. And most people who are in those types of hate movements were not raised in those types of environments, believe it or not. I was raised in kind of a completely opposite environment that was full of love. And my parents are immigrants that came to the United States in the mid-1960s. So, you know, racism wasn't part of my DNA. In fact, they were sometimes the victims of prejudice when they arrived from Italy. So, you know, as a young kid, I was surrounded by a lot of love, but I was also in a situation where my parents were never home because they had to work extremely hard to support kind of this immigrant family. So I kind of grew up detached from my parents and raised by grandparents and aunts and uncles on the south side of Chicago, and grew to really resent my parents for not being there. You know, it wasn't for a lack of love. I knew they loved me. They didn't hit me. They didn't have vices. It wasn't an unsafe space to be in. I just resented them not being there, and I felt abandoned by them. So at a young age, about 13 years old, I started to explore outside of the family for that sense of family. And at 14 years old in 1987, I was standing in an alley on the south side of Chicago smoking a joint. And a guy with a shaved head and boots came up to me, and he pulled the joint from my mouth. And he looked me in the eyes and he said, "That's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile." I'm telling you guys, at 14 years old, I didn't know what the hell a communist was. I didn't know if I'd met a Jewish person. I didn't even know what the word docile meant. But it was the first time in my life that somebody I felt had paid attention to me and kind of drew me in. And I know now that that man, who was twice my age, was a predator. He was looking for, you know, somebody at 14 years old to draw into a hate movement. And in fact, this man was America's first neo-Nazi skinhead leader. And he recruited me that day. And I fell for that sense of family that I was missing at home. So I spent 8 years as part of that movement, and I kind of rose through the ranks, and I became a propagandist and a leader myself within those 8 years. But at some point, I started to recognize that it was not who I was. It was that hate that I was carrying around, and the violence and all the victimization that I was using against other, I was victimizing other people, was really kind of like a suit of armor that I was wearing somehow to protect myself from the sense of identity, community, and purpose that I was chasing. So at some point, I had to envision, you know, a strategy to get myself out of that, because nobody before me had really left that movement. And certainly those who had tried were not looked upon as you know, very good people or treated very well.
Tell me about the dawning piece. Like, how did you become aware that this was not a, like, the way that you were living was not a reflection of who you actually were, if I can put it that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think the day after that alley meeting, I started to recognize it wasn't the place that I should have been. However, it was also very enticing and intoxicating to be there. So I think a lot like a drug, somebody who might use a drug for the first time is unsure of it, but it gets easier. It became easier for me to be in that world because I was getting a reward from it. And I'm putting up air quotes for anybody who's just listening and not watching, but the reward that I was getting was the sense of respect. And it wasn't respect, it was fear, right? I had gone from being this bullied and very introverted kind of little kid who grew up not really, you know, feeling a sense of family and home, who had been picked on throughout, like, you know, elementary school, to suddenly being this bully myself. And I had, you know, this group of friends now, these skinheads, these racist skinheads who had surrounded me, who kind of gave me this false sense of agency. So for 8 years, I carried that around. But I have to tell you both, there's not one day of those 8 years that I didn't, deep down inside, question what it was that I was involved in. But it became harder and harder to get out as I got deeper and deeper.
Okay, that's super interesting. What was your relationship with the part of you that could sense, or the part of you that knew this wasn't like a true fit? Again, please fix my language. I don't want to describe things for you. Yeah. What was your relationship with your knowing that this wasn't exactly right?
It was a lot of conversation inside my head, right? It was a lot of discomfort with myself in all sorts of situations. Even being in that very comfortable world where I was feeling empowered, I felt uncomfortable there because I did feel different than everybody else because I was having these doubts. I thought I was the only one, right? But at the same time, I was asking for respect in those circles, so I had to do more to earn it in those circles. So I was going even against myself. So I was having these very deep kind of quiet conversations with myself, telling myself that I was wrong because I was feeling guilty for what I was doing. But at the same time, I wasn't raised that way. I mean, like, it felt so foreign to me, but at the same time, I was enjoying the rewards of it from this new group of people. So it was kind of like living two lives in secret.
So what was the kind of experience living in such a kind of polarizing internal state? Like, empowered, you said, which is interesting because we're on Empowered Human Academy, and also guilt and kind of shame, internal shame. What was that like for you?
Yeah, I'm glad you used the word shame, because that was one that I would accurately describe myself as going through at the time. I was very ashamed, especially once I decided to leave and try and make amends for what I had done wrong, because then I felt very, very ashamed for it as I was starting to let my guard down to be able to talk to people about what I had done to repair the harm that I had caused. But yeah, I mean, it was really difficult. And I think throughout the years, now we're talking about 30 years later, right? Here we are in 2021, and the world is the way it is now. And I think what that did to me, that kind of duality of living, it traumatized me. I am dealing now, I think, with so much of the PTSD, I suppose, with battling against who I was so violently, both realistically and metaphorically speaking, so violently with who I felt I needed to become. And I think that kind of did create a bit of a tear inside of me.
Yeah, totally. Thanks for sharing that. What was it like to know the dawning of realization that you needed to leave?
The point at which it became no longer worth it to stay.
And then tell us a little bit about the strategy that went behind it, like, if in specifics, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were several of those moments. It wasn't just one kind of light switch moment. There were, you know, every day I had doubts, but there were definitely the kind of like major kind of milestones. One of them was at 19 years old, you know, I was married, I had my first child, and at 21 had our second child. And that was the first thing that happened to me in my life that questioned my sense of identity, community, and purpose. because the only other identity, community, and purpose that I had known before then was being a neo-Nazi, you know, skinhead with that family and with a purpose of, you know, being this white warrior. And suddenly I was a father and I was a husband, and that was my community. And my purpose was to provide for them. So it was instantly came into conflict with each other. They couldn't coexist. So that was the first thing that said, ah, something's wrong and I need to start thinking about a different way. But I still wasn't brave enough to do it. The second one, I think, happened when I opened a record store in 1994. And that was partly because I wanted to legitimize my lifestyle. I, you know, I was tired of being out on the streets. I was, the violence didn't, couldn't coexist with the family that I was trying to start. So I tried to legitimize the hate by starting a record store that would sell hate music. But I also sold hip hop and punk rock and heavy metal and, you know, kind of underground independent music of the time in the mid 90s. And even though I was selling a lot of the hate music, both that I was making and that I was importing from places like Europe, I started to meet people of color and people who were gay, people who were Jewish at my store, who came in to buy this other stuff or to just shop around, or whether they were just curious about the Nazi in their neighborhood, they came into my store to challenge me. And it was through those experiences where I wanted to be decent as a business person, where I let my guard down and I started to see them as people. And I saw them as people and friends, even more so than I saw the people I'd surrounded myself with as friends and as people. And I eventually removed all the racist music and shut the store down because of that. And that was my strategy. So if we want to talk about strategy, my strategy was not so brave. It was to lie to the movement that I was a part of, that I was leading. I shut my store down. My wife and my children had left me at the time, and I had hit rock bottom, essentially, outside of the movement. Inside of the movement, I was at my peak. Outside of the movement, I had hit rock bottom. So what I told the movement was, is I needed time to rebuild my family, to find a job, to, you know, kind of take care of things, and that I would be back. I had no intention of going back, so I ran as fast as I could away from it. That was my strategy, except I never moved. I stayed in the same house, in the same neighborhood, and what I did is I started to live a different life outside of that movement that incorporated people of color and people who were different than me and people that I thought I hated, because I wanted to experience that. And I fell in love with that world. And I found out that I had been a captive in this other world for 8 years. So my strategy was really not so bravely intentioned. I'm sorry to say, I wish I would have told them off, but it took me a couple of years to do that. It took me, you know, took me until like 2000 to really kind of turn around and talk about my experience. And I've been doing that for almost 22 years now.
Yeah. And doing so powerfully. I have so many questions. Same. One of my questions is, like, talk to me about beginning to talk about this. Like, now you've got 20 years under your belt of exploring this story with other people. I'm sure we'll talk about that too, but talk to me about the very beginning. Like, why be open about this? And what was it like sharing more intimately about this stuff with the people who would have been on the other side of the hate? And also people who, like, aren't connected to it, like other white cis people, not labeling you, but, like, I'm curious about the beginning, I suppose.
It was terrifying. I mean, it was the scariest thing I ever had to do, because I was, you know, when I chose to talk about it, well, actually, the first time I chose to address it, I hadn't spoken about it publicly. I chose to address it with somebody that I had hurt in the past. Yeah. And it was in 1999, and it was a kind of a, you can call it fate, you can call it karma, you can call it luck, whatever. But in 1999, I'd gone through that. So I'd left the movement in 96, or walked away. That's when I closed my store, walked away. And in 1999, I was kind of still at my bottom personally, but I was away from that movement. And I had one friend who came to me, and she was concerned about me because I didn't have a job. Still, I was kind of bouncing around from odd jobs and things like that. And she said, like, you know, listen, you need to go apply where I just started working. And it was this little tiny tech company called IBM. So I thought she was nuts. She's, you know, asking me, an ex-Nazi who still, like, really had no computer experience at all. She said, go apply at IBM and we'll see about changing this life path that you're on. And I thought she was crazy. But I went, and it was an entry-level position, thankfully. And I went to the interview and I got it. And it was kind of setting up computers for corporations and universities once they would refresh all their systems, and somebody would come in and install like 200 or 300, you know, workstations and make sure all the imaging was correct and everything. And it was a totally entry-level job. And I was so thrilled when they offered me the job until they told me where I was going to be going my first day of work. And it was actually the same high school that to install the computers for the high school district for that summer, the same one I'd been kicked out of, you know, several years before that. And it was like, IBM had no idea about my past. I certainly didn't tell them, you know, I was kind of totally covering all it up at that point. But I knew the minute I was going to walk into my old high school, the same one I'd been kicked out of twice, somebody was going to like recognize me and like the jig was up at that point. I would lose my job. But I decided I was going to face it head on. And I went to work that day and it was 1999. And one of the first people that I saw walking into my old high school was the black security guard whose life I had made hell when I had gone to high school there. As a white supremacist, right? Yeah. So I decided I was going to confront it then. I had not until that point confronted it. I had changed my life. I'd learned, you know, I'd gotten new friends. I'd chosen a different life path, but I'd never held myself accountable for what I'd done. So I decided to go after this man who knew me very well, but didn't recognize me when he had seen me in the hallway. And when I saw him, I reintroduced myself and he was afraid. He took a step back when I introduced myself again, and he allowed me to apologize to him, at which point he said, that's a really good start, but it's not good enough. He said, you have to fix what you broke. Mm-hmm. And that's when he became a mentor of mine and this man, John Holmes, who is now still to this day, 20 some years later, a mentor to me. He's the one who challenged me that day. He said, you know, your redemption is not going to be complete until you hold yourself accountable. And that's when I started to go out into the world and tell my story for the first time. And the first time I told it was at a class at DePaul University, because when IBM hired me, they also offered to, you know, about a year later, send me to college. And it was in my first class at DePaul University in 2000 when I started to talk about my past. And I talked about it in front of a full class of, you know, 30 or 40 people for the first time. And I think I made it about halfway through without just completely breaking down because I was so ashamed of everything that I had done. And this was a class, you know, a very diverse class full of people from every stripe and background. And it was the first time that those words were leaving my lips and the first time I had actually held myself accountable.
Okay. So your now mentor, I suppose, used the word redemption. What does that mean? How does that word feel to you now? Like part of me wants to like ask, like, are you redeemed? But mostly I'm curious about like, how do you feel about the concept of needing redemption, needing to make amends? And is that a finished work? Is that a finishable work? How do you think about all of that?
If I were to just talk about it in a broad sense, I think redemption without accountability is just another form of privilege. I think we must be accountable. But I also don't know that I can tap myself on the shoulder and say, you are redeemed. That's not my job. Somebody, I suppose, will tell me someday. But in the meantime, you know, I still continue to go out into the world trying to repair the harm that I've caused. I don't know that I'll ever get there. I mean, I think forgiveness and redemption are a different thing. I've learned to forgive myself through the work that I've done, but I don't know that I am the one who has the power to say you are redeemed. I think that's somebody else's job.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I hadn't thought about like the internal, external side of that. Talk to me about forgiving yourself and that whole thing, like, and the evolution of that, I suppose, like whether or not you felt like you needed to and what your relationship is to that now.
Yeah, I mean, I think it happened very recently because I had to recognize that I am not that person that I used to be, right? I'm not that 14-year-old. I'm not that 20-year-old. I'm not even that 23-year-old. In fact, at 47, I'm not even that 35-year-old, you know, anymore. I am not that person anymore. So I've had to forgive that person to be able to measure who I am today, right? Like I have to kind of set a stake in the ground to measure progress. I have to start somewhere. So at some point I had to learn to maybe forgive myself is not the right word, but to let that person go so that the new one can grow. And I've had to do that. I think over and over and over again, I always kind of question myself because I'm not perfect. You know, we're always learning every day. But I think I have had to kind of say, you know, I acknowledge that person as somebody who doesn't exist anymore today.
What is it? Okay. So much, if I understand correctly and tell me if I'm wrong, a lot of your time goes to telling the story of someone who you are not anymore. What is that like, right? Like some people have the luxury of just like forgetting a past life, but here you've built so much of your own life's work on telling that story. Maybe you'd phrase it differently. Like, is it from an external perspective, it kind of looks like telling the story of a past self. How would you characterize that, though? And how does that all feel, especially given the work of self-forgiveness in the now?
Yeah, I mean, I think I kind of have to look at that person as a case study, right? As a subject, almost, as somebody I have let go to be able to analyze, you know, having very intimate knowledge, obviously. I mean, both in this case, the zookeeper studying the animal and the animal who has learned to speak and use their voice. So I've had to kind of learn to do both. Honestly, I mean, I've told my story over 1,000 times publicly, whether it's through interviews or on stage, through speaking engagement or training or briefing or otherwise. And I had to at some point learn to treat that as a different person because it was becoming traumatizing to me to always talk about myself in the frame of the worst things I've ever done in my life, right? So now I have to balance that with the work that I've been doing for the last 20 years is focused on helping people like that 14-year-old kid or that 20-year-old kid disengage from hate. So that is what I've been focused on. So I've kind of learned to be able to talk about that person almost as somebody else that I've studied.
So speaking of the work that you've been doing, I have two questions. The first is, what has it been like in the last 20 years with your activism in terms of getting people out? Has there been hate towards you in ways from the neo-Nazi group, from other kind of radical groups that kind of see you as maybe a threat because you kind of are exposing them? What has that been like in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a very tiring 20 years, both because of being on the defensive from the people that I used to know, because I am now somebody who has great insight into that movement, as somebody who was an insider, as a leader, a strategist within that movement, is now a strategist against that movement. And it's been, to be honest with you, though, it's been even more tiring because nobody has been listening for the last 20 years about the threats that we are facing today. That has been the most disheartening thing, you know, because I know what the bad guys are capable of, right?
Totally.
What has been the most disheartening is having the insight, having the knowledge, knowing the tactics that could have diffused the situation that we are in now 20 years later, much, much worse than we were in 20 years ago. In the world, in a society where, you know, white supremacy, racism, hatred, extremism is kind of at the top of everybody's minds these days, knowing that we had this information to defeat it so long ago, but there has never been a will to combat it. And even now, there isn't really a will. We live in a society where we're still having the argument of whether racism and hate exists. There are a significant, you know, percentage of our population that believes that that is a fairy tale, while the other half is, you know, or arguably, you know, a significant part of the other half is still experiencing the effects of racism and hatred and prejudice.
Totally. Okay. So there's so many questions I have. Okay. So in your experience then, what are some kind of strategies? Let's get practical. Number one, what do you see today as a tactic that people are using on the hatred side? And I think that this is like, I'm asking this because I, for one, as a gay Latino, want to be aware of situations where I might be, you know, discriminated against. Like, I don't travel to some countries because they don't have protections for people who are queer. So what are some tactics that you see that are kind of like subconscious or like things that we just kind of have normalized now that are a tactic of the hate? And then how do we combat those tactics?
Yeah, I mean, I think probably the most effective tactic is misinformation, right? Mm-hmm. We are living in the age of kind of misinformation and disinformation as we start to spread that misinformation around. And that was a kind of the foundation of what the white supremacist movement was about, conspiracy theories, fear-mongering, othering, all of these kind of tactics rooted in facts, right? That were back then on the fringe, right? In the 80s and 90s, it was very much a fringe movement. We are now in 2021 dealing with a very mainstream extremist movement where a lot of those propagandists with disinformation and misinformation are large news networks, are politicians, are people who are in positions of power. So that is the way it's been normalized. Also, this has always also occurred is hiding behind patriotism, right? It is not patriotic to marginalize people within your own communities. It is not patriotic to put a flag and an ideology over, you know, your own neighbors and your own, the people that, you know, that call yourself neighbor, that call themselves neighbors. So, yeah, I mean, I think that what has happened is we've gone from a period of this being very fringe, what I call boots to suits. This has gone from a fringe to the mainstream now. We have people, you know, who we've normally trusted or at least looked up to kind of spewing the same things that I did when I was 14 years old.
How do we make it better?
Well, you know, I think digital literacy is an important part of this, and understanding what it is that we come across in this vast frontier of the internet and how to kind of parse through that. I think that's so important for young people, but also older people. It wasn't a bunch of teenagers who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. It was retirees and people in their 40s and 50s. And these are people also who at that point in their life, interestingly, are looking for a new sense of identity, community, and purpose. Newly retired people, not just young people who are searching for those things. Totally. But it's people who've gone through a whole life of what I call potholes, things that detoured them, trauma that detoured them to the fringes where a very toxic sense of identity, community, and purpose took hold of them. And if you think about retirees, they've lived a whole life. They've experienced divorce. They've experienced death, grief, things like that, job loss. And when they retire, they're starting with a whole new identity, community, and purpose, even sometimes in a new state. Right. Mm-hmm. And they're being informed on places like Facebook where this misinformation exists and is affecting them greatly. I think we can all relate to that. We all know somebody who's kind of gone down the wrong, you know, rabbit hole in recent years.
Totally. One of our best friends works for Instagram, and they started the team of equity for the product. And they are actively trying to combat racism, bullying, misinformation. It's just such like it's a machine out there that is actually super scary, because if you don't take hold of it, then it's going to change like the ecosystem of our society in all the ways. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Two questions. Lighter one first. What I want to ask is like, where do you find the hope in this? But I don't want to assume that you do. So talk to me about like the role of hope in this and the presence or absence thereof in this work that you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think I have to have hope doing what I'm doing. Otherwise, I would just crawl into a hole and just give up. And I think where I find hope is that we are a resilient people, right? We do, you know, even if it's uncomfortable, eventually learn how to survive. But that's not to say I'm not deeply concerned about the moment we're in right now, because it could go in a terribly wrong direction if we allow it to. If we continue to try to meet in the middle with people who are never interested in meeting in the middle, right? It's a tactic for them, right? Yeah. Because, you know, when we talk about generally speaking, meeting in the middle on ideas and things like that, it means we are going over to their side. We are dipping a toe into their belief system and somehow desensitizing us in a way that, you know, it allows us to consider it. They're not interested in meeting in the middle. What they're interested in doing is pulling you towards the middle, which means pulling you closer to their side. So I think that this is a moment where, kind of against what I often preach, which is like compassion and empathy is what allows people to kind of break free of hate, we also have to learn to hold people accountable as kind of the puppet masters who are the quote unquote drug dealers, so to speak, who are intoxicating everybody. That's important. We can't let that escape accountability at the same time.
Hey friends, if you've been resonating with the energy here and feel open to exploring what it means for you to be connected to your own aliveness, then we'd love for you to apply to be a guest on Empowered Human Academy.
Simply head over to eha.party, fill out a quick form, and we'll be in touch if it feels aligning. Or if someone else comes to mind that you'd love to hear on the podcast, send us your ideas. We'd love to hear them. Again, just go over to eha.party, fill out the form, and we'll keep on exploring together. Now, back to the conversation.
You said that we eventually learn. How do you think about the fact that like experience teaches, and you yourself, like you only left the movement when it was time for you to leave the movement? That was an internal, from what I understand, that was an internally determined. How do you think about the fact that we are like everyone's on their own path, timeline, things make sense when they make sense? Hmm. How does that idea coexist with the idea that maybe we can help each other? How can we teach knowing that someone may not be ready to learn? And when we're looking back at society and the trillion of ways that we're all interacting with each other, how does that all fit? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we almost have to operate on two tracks simultaneously right now, okay. Right? One of those is a little bit more uncertain and maybe not quite as effective, but necessary. And when I say two tracks, one is prevention. We have to prevent future generations from going down that path or from being susceptible to those types of really hateful ideas, right? So we need to do a better, more intentional job of teaching better values to young people and you know, inclusive values and understanding how words and actions have affected people both now and in the past, right? We're in this moment where we're debating whether we should talk about our history, right? Whether we should include everything that's actually happened or somehow sanitizing it. That's not going to create a better, more inclusive and understanding society. Right. Yeah. I'm not a scientist, but I can gather that is going to be the case, that if we are raising children with not all the information, it is destined to fail. So, you know, and I'm talking about this critical race theory and this nonsense about that. How do we deal with the problem we have right now, the people who are in it? And I think I said it's more uncertain and maybe not as effective because I think that we have to understand we are going to lose some people in this process. We can't save everybody, because like you said, it took an internal decision for me to say it's time to leave. Luckily, I had people who 20 years ago, maybe it was easier because I took accountability for myself or whatever, but there were people who said, hey, I believe in you, even though you're a bad dude. I see something inside of you that like is worth nurturing. Mm-hmm. I don't know that exists so much these days. And I think even as somebody like me who benefited from people's compassion in getting out is also finding it very hard to be compassionate to some of these people who are saying and doing these really awful things. I feel like we're talking about this now. They should know. There's a line in the sand that says, if you want to continue to do this, go down that road, but know that there are consequences potentially. But also, if you want to leave, there is a safe passage for you, but it requires accountability for what you've done. And I feel like we have to draw that line in the sand and let people choose, and we may not be able to save everybody.
Yeah. You're talking specifically about people in hate groups, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And I think what's interesting, what comes to mind for me is this. You were talking about like meeting in the middle and this concept of understanding that, you know, the human experience is so complex, but racism is bad and murder is bad and all these different things, right? So what do you think, you're a strategist, and what do you think is the approach of the state that we're in now, where people are just kind of yelling at each other that aren't identifying as a person that has hate in their heart? What is, like, in your opinion, a good kind of solution or approach to get people to kind of come together when things are so polarizing right now?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, there is no person in a hate group that will admit to being in a hate group. I mean, it's like they can't even admit. They think that they're all about love, that they think that they're about protecting something versus, you know, eliminating what they see as the threat. So that I think is the first thing to understand. So shame in many ways doesn't work on them. So I think, you know, if we're speaking generally, what I do a lot when I work with people is I listen, right? And I'm not listening to the ideology. I don't tolerate the things, the jabs, the arrows and things like that. What I'm doing is I'm trying to filter that out and get to kind of the fundamental things about life that I might actually have in common with that person. You know, challenges with life, family, hobbies, things like that. If we know that we can meet in the middle on that, right? And I'm saying meet in the middle, not ideologically, but on the things that we all fundamentally share. If we can meet in the middle there, we may get off track eventually, right? But we always have a point of reference to go back to. But if we start out on the opposite ends immediately, just kind of yelling at each other with the things that we know we will never penetrate anybody, we never have that point of reference to go back to. Right. So I think as a society, we are also struggling right now with a sense of identity, community, and purpose as a nation, as a people, right? Not just individually, but as a general society. And I think that we need to reestablish that so we have some things to meet fundamentally in the middle on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that a scalable work? I mean, the problem is large and spans nations. What you're proposing sounds very intimate. How do we think about those two facts?
Well, yeah. I mean, now you're talking about something that is actually, you know, very relative to the problem. Is this isn't just an American problem, right? This is a global problem, you know, and in some places equally as disturbing as is here in our home country. Is it scalable? Gosh, I sure hope so, because we need to. But I think every version, every society is going to have its different variation of it. And maybe that is a sense of kind of like, and I hate to use the word like nationalism because it has really intentional bad connotations, but almost a sense of like the civic kind of inclusive nationalism, right? Mm-hmm. Where we are proud enough of what we have that we want to share it and also enjoy other people's cultures, not necessarily overpower them. So I don't know, maybe if we're, you know, can kind of clean up our own homes and then, you know, everybody else does the same, we can eventually find a way to play together nice.
Has there been like kind of share in maybe a little inspirational story or a positive story about someone or a group that you've worked with in the last 20 years to kind of get them out of hate groups and what that experience was like?
Yeah. And I think it's important first when we talk about hate groups, we're not talking about like the Klan. We're not talking about like, you know, neo-Nazi skinheads. That really doesn't exist anymore. When we say hate groups now, we're talking really about kind of just a movement of hate, right? That they all kind of fall under the same umbrella of exclusion of other people. And in many cases, you know, violence against other people. I don't want people to think that like, you know, we're dealing with like Klan groups or those still exist, but that has really evolved into kind of more of a mainstream problem. There are so many stories of hope. And I think that sometimes the most hopeful ones are the ones that I had absolutely nothing to do with, where somebody emails me and says, hey, I've heard your story, or I've saw your talk once, and then I followed everything you've done, and I was just like you. I was a member of a hate group, and because of, you know, the example you said, I found my way out. To me, sometimes those are the most inspirational because it means that the work that I'm doing has further reaching effects. But more personally, I mean, I've worked on some cases where real lives have been saved in some instances. There was a young girl in Florida, a 17-year-old girl whose parents contacted me, and she was being courted by, you know, an online boyfriend, a neo-Nazi who had recruited her to make propaganda videos, to make her the face of these propaganda videos, because he recognized a young, pretty girl could potentially attract more boys to kind of this movement. What she didn't know, though, however, was that this person was several people kind of high, you know, catfishing her, one of which was sitting in California, another one who was sitting in Russia, another one who was sitting somewhere else in Eastern Europe. And they were all kind of working together to pretend to be this one person who became her boyfriend. And they were getting her to do all these things until eventually the one character who was pretending to be her boyfriend in California actually abducted this girl. And through a series of events that transpired during that time, I was able to actually physically intervene and rescue this girl and get her to her parents and make sure that who knows what would have happened to her, but it was a bad situation getting worse. So that's kind of on the extreme end. And then on the other, you know, end, it's really about a lot of just kind of being an ear for somebody to talk to when they have questions that they have nobody else to ask, because it's not a safe place to really kind of raise those kinds of concerns about maybe I want to leave.
Yeah. Mm. And in this work, there's probably a lot of traumatic things you were talking about in your experience and then hearing traumatic things. How do you stay healthy? How have you kind of paved this, you know, path for yourself of healing, of wholeness, of hope, of positivity?
Well, I think one of the most important things that I started to realize was this notion of kind of secondary trauma or compassion fatigue, which I've had to become very careful of, not only because of what I participated in and still kind of working through that and definitely talking to a counselor about that on a regular basis and just other life issues, which I highly recommend, but also recognizing that working with other people who are in these movements, so the people I'm counseling to get out of these hate movements, experiencing their trauma had an effect on me. I started to accumulate, and their trauma was traumatizing me. So I suffered from like a period where I couldn't understand why my own life was kind of starting to dip back down. And it was because I was absorbing and carrying all that. So I've had to learn how to deal with, you know, this notion of secondary trauma or compassion fatigue. And that involves, you know, trying to take care of myself, talking to people, myself, and recognizing when it starts to happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You've gotten into an answer to my next question, which is, I want to say on the heels, you're not done telling the story. You're not done with this work, but this far along into it, and not necessarily making it about the work itself, but going back to that identity question, like how is your personhood expanding like now, today? Yeah. Like where are you at? What's happening?
Yeah. You know, I think that I've been just so fortunate to kind of be graced with this idea of credibility, you know, after the awful things that I've done. So, I take very good very careful stewardship of that. I always kind of try and live my life or the things that I present to people with a lot of responsibility. So I'm honored by that, that I've been one, given a second chance in a society where, unfortunately, where people that don't look like me aren't even given first chances sometimes. Yeah. I want to raise that. But one of the ways I've done it is really to kind of be an insight, a very unique insight. You know, I mentioned that I am a lot like an animal, like a zoo animal that finally found their voice and started speaking and said, hey, you know, I can explain this whole thing to you. So one of the ways I've done that is, you know, through a TV show where I've shown the kind of the inside of the work that I do, disengaging people. But also another one is through a podcast that I've launched called F Your Racist History that talks about all of kind of the racist origin stories that we weren't taught about in school. So that has been really, you know, kind of the impetus of that was over the last 20 years, all the things that I learned about how racist, you know, kind of held other people back for hundreds of years, not just like in the 80s and the 90s. And as we think about this recently, that it really is kind of the foundation of why we are where we are today. And it's, and talking about those things is cathartic in a sense too.
We will link those two projects of yours in our show notes so people can look out for that and engage in whatever way they want to. What are some ingredients in your mind and in your work and that kind of resonate with you? What are the ingredients for people to become more, to combat anti-hate? Or to be more...
What's the opposite? What's the word that we're looking for?
Yeah. Like, you know, the anti-racist work. It's anti-hate work. You know what I mean? Yeah.
To become more loving? How do you say this?
Yeah. I mean, I think we have to embrace anti-racism, right? Because as part of anti-racism, it encompasses kind of all the other othering that we've done as well, right? I mean, you know, against the LGBTQ community, against, you know, immigrants, against other religions, against whatever. And I think this idea, this notion that we are above it, that we are not racist, I think we need to examine that. I think we are all complicit in it. We all live in a society that really is built around racism and in many ways still is very racist. So I think we have to have very uncomfortable kind of not conversations with other people. We have to start with ourselves. We have to really acknowledge in a very uncomfortable way how maybe we've been complicit in this in some way or another. And what we actually have the power to do to change that, right? None of us can change the world. You know, maybe we can, but, you know, we all have the power to change our own worlds, our own ecosystems around us, whether, you know, it's owning a company and intentionally doing your hiring to be, you know, more inclusive and representative, or whether it's about the way we just treat other people, the way we might open a door for somebody that maybe we wouldn't do it before, or just acknowledging other people on the street. I always say that eyes are much prettier than pixels. You know, we're always kind of like looking at our phones for answers when really the answers are always kind of like walking by us throughout the day. We just need to learn to look for them and to listen for them and to you know, ask for those answers sometimes. And I think the most important thing is we have to learn to be cautiously vulnerable, all of us, as adults, as teachers, as, you know, as people, one, to young people, because how will they ever learn to be able to talk to us about what they're insecure about or what they have questions about if they see us as, like, you know, infallible, right? We have to learn to be fallible with them so they can be fallible and vulnerable with us. And I think we have to understand, too, that there is a universality in this brokenness. We are all somewhat fractured. And once we understand that we all kind of can share that with each other, that's kind of the universal glue, I think, that will pull us together. We kind of need each other.
So how would you phrase, okay, so going back to the language of being a creator, like way back at the beginning of this conversation, it's easy to talk about, it's easy for me to think of this work as an undoing, as a deconstruction. Can you phrase it for me in terms of creation? Like, what are we creating instead?
Yeah, I mean, it really is kind of a reconstruction, I think, if anything. Sure, it requires a deconstruction of kind of habits and preconceived notions. And but we have to remember that those notions weren't always there, right? We didn't start out born from the womb as haters, right? We didn't, you know, I didn't, you know, go to kindergarten with a swastika armband. I mean, I learned to hate. So I have to unlearn to do that. But it's also not really about so much about unlearning as it is about relearning that original person, that understanding the basis of that person so that we can get past the insecurities and the notions of how other people might see us, because I was so insecure. And that is a lot of the reason why I put on that suit of armor of hate to protect myself and to use as a weapon. So I think we must be more comfortable with this notion of who we are. So it is really kind of about understanding who we were to begin with, because I think I'm that same, you know, 6 or 7 year old.
And speaking of creating that, how did, before we kind of wrap up, how did you recreate this Christian Piccolini that you know and love today? I mean, I'm not putting words in your mouth, but I love you. So it's like that we know and love today.
Well, I love you both too. And I think one of the first things I had to do was learn to love myself. And maybe for the first time, I think, once I started to go down this path, how to love myself for the first time. So I had to create a vision. First, I had to understand who I was, who the foundation of me was. But then I had to create a vision of what I wanted that person to accomplish. And it wasn't always comfortable. It wasn't always taking the easy way out. In fact, it probably was not really about taking the easy way out at all. At first, you know, at first attempt, I put myself on a stage and kind of took my, you know, clothes off and bared my soul. And I've been doing that ever since. And I think even more so. But it was really about getting comfortable with that vulnerability, I think, was the most important thing.
What gives you the answers, however you want, what gives you the guts, the determination, like to do some of this? Like, what makes it that first move, like getting up on stage, as you just said, what makes it worth it?
Well, truth, I think, is important to me, because I spent so much of my, you know, time before that living in kind of untruths. So it was once I discovered a path towards the truth, I didn't ever want to let it go, because I was afraid that if I let it go, I wouldn't recognize it again. So I've always been kind of making sure that I chase it. And that's what I meant when I first said I feel very responsible about the words that I say, because I was very irresponsible about those words for 8 years of my life. I mean, I think it's so important. I didn't want to see anybody else go down that path. I didn't want having that information. I didn't want there to be a void of it. And even though there wasn't, you know, for 20 years, I've been screaming about it. Unfortunately, people weren't really listening until now.
I'm going to dig a little bit further. Why is truth important to you?
I think truth is important to me, again, because, you know, it was kind of missing from my life for such a long time. And now I know the value of it. But I also know that it's the one thing that we can rely on to go back to, as long as we don't obscure it. And again, I'll say this. I think once we lose truth, we may not know what it looks like anymore. And we may not know enough to go back to it. So that's why it's so, so important that we hang on to it.
Whoa. I feel that. I think Isaac and I, in our whole marriage and how we do life, is we don't tell lies. We are very truthful with every single thing, because the more you wrap yourself in a web of kind of lies or untruth, it's harder to, like you said, go back what is true anymore if everything was kind of built off of lies. And I felt that in my core, because I think there's power and there's freedom, actual freedom and joy and health when you're kind of living in that truth. Go ahead.
Truth is interesting enough. Why do we have to, you know, make stuff up? I mean, it really is fascinating.
Totally. Totally. There's always something to work with truth as well. I love, just before we ask our last final questions, I love that I had to say this, and I think it's really beautiful that security guard at your high school is your mentor and a friend now. And I think it takes, I know many people, my dad is one of them, the people who have wronged them. I love people who can forgive and kind of love on the people who have wronged them in the past. I think that's such an amazing characteristic of the human experience that I'm just so fascinated with, because it's that open-handed kind of acceptance and reconciliation process that really changes us. And that's awesome. So, penultimate question. What does an empowered Christian Piccolini look like and feel like?
I think you're looking at him. No, I mean, I think it's a confident person who is unafraid to make mistakes, but to be responsible about moving forward so that it doesn't negatively affect anybody else, right? Like, I take responsibility now for my actions moving forward, good or bad. And I think that there's a lot of power in that. So I think understanding I'm not perfect, understanding that I am an evolution in progress, that we all are, is very empowering, because I know that I am today not the best person that I will be. And that's something to look forward to.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Love that.
And on the having just discussed all the aspects of truth that we just had on the table, last question is, what do you know for sure?
I don't know. I think part of the tricky thing of moving forward with intention and responsibility is admitting that I don't know anything for sure. One thing I do know for sure, and this I think gives me the strength to move forward, is the confidence to know that I don't want to go backwards. That backwards to me is wrong. And that is what I'm sure about.
Cool. Mm. Cool. Christian, thank you for your time in this. I like so many other people, when anyone else like shares earnestly, like something that is as real as a life, there's great potential in that for all those who get to listen. So thank you for sharing today.
My pleasure. Isaac, thank you and Abe for your friendship, for your support, and for the future.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Y'all, the whole point of everything is to open up ourselves in all the fullness that we're made for, and then to create, create, create with everything that is real and true and bright. That's the work of a life. That's what we're working on. And you're here because you feel that for yourself, too, and we believe in you completely.
And hey, if you want to take a deeper dive, then head over to Apple Podcasts and sign up for a subscription, giving you access to exclusive bonus content. We've recorded a companion episode where we digest the themes of this week's conversation and swap art recommendations, sharing what's giving us life at the moment. It's a lot of fun. We've also put together a free downloadable you'll find at empoweredhumanacademy.com with a table question, journal prompt, and action step to bring the energy of today's episode home to your own life. And if you're resonating with the exploration that we're doing here, if these interviews have meant something to you, then we'd love for you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us spread the word and get these episodes out to more people.
Thank you for being here, for choosing to spend some time with us. Now, get out there and do something that feels exactly like you, and we'll do the same.
And for us, that includes bringing you the next conversation. Until then, stay close to your heart, to your breath, and to your power. Have an amazing, amazing day.